CliffCentral.com.
Okay, lots of stuff to get to today. We've got a couple of news things we want to tell you about, and we will take your messages, your calls, your thoughts, whatever it might be, 0797482090. Let's see what we've got in terms of good news, since Pumi brought up the fact, and she's right, that people are not interested in bad news this week. Let's see how long it lasts.
Yes.
Yeah, because, you know, humans have this natural inclination to bad news. So let's see how long we can stave that off, shall
and
we?
And what was also nice to see is, you know, people aren't cyberbullying Rachel. Rachel Godisi. She had lots of support.
Oh, right.
Over the
weekend. Yeah, sure. Because she, that woman has been like in fighting spirits from the get-go on social media. It's like she's defending her turf the whole time.
Yeah.
Against white people, against black people, against women, against men. It's just insane how much nonsense she has to put up with.
No, it was, yeah. But over the weekend, I kind of, you know, she became like the Makoti of the nation.
But it's frustrating that this even needs to be a thing. Guys, it's their relationship. Let's get out of it and call it a day. But, yeah, I saw a lot of photos of the Khaleesi's and, like, from yesteryear. It's like, oh, well, no, she's in it for the right reasons.
Oh, yeah.
She loved him before he was successful. I'm like, well, screw it. We are not involved. Let them be.
Yeah, but you know what people are like? They've got horrible, boring lives, so they have to make their lives more interesting by getting involved in other people's lives. It's the reality.
Yeah, but she got lots of love.
No, sure.
She got lots of love.
Sure. I'm just glad you brought it up.
Yeah, you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't, because I still also saw a couple of people comment on the fact that Siya Khaleesi has two elder kids before his two kids with Rachel, and people are like,
but they're
where
not
are
his
those kids?
Kids?
Where,
but they're not his kids. They're his it's his sister and his brother. It's his mother's children.
Okay, give me the tissues. That actually makes me love him even more then.
It's his mother's children.
Siya is... Yes, sis. Yo, he is the man of the match. By the way, did I just happen to listen to some of the videos of like Sia's name being chanted?
Oh, you loved it because it was Sia. You just thought it was for you. Are they? They're coming back today, right?
They're coming back today, and then they're on a tour. They're on a victory tour starting Thursday.
Good.
Starting off on Thursday.
As much as I'm one to quickly say, let's not get involved in Rachel and Sia's relationship. Can I get involved in their finances? Can I get involved in their finances?
Sia. All right, yeah, go for it.
Because I'll never forget, and I still do feel bad for our poor rowing team when they won at the Olympics. And I think our rowing team got silver, which was around 200,000 rand. And we're like, oh, that's so amazing.
But that
because
split it
there
between...
were four of them, they had to divide it by four. So as much as Chad Leclerc was on top of the world, but he was, you know, swimming in his own lane, excuse the pun, so he got the full prize money, our poor swimmers had to divide it. So I wonder how it works in rugby. I wonder what the payday is. And how...
It's very good.
Yeah.
The payday is always good in rugby.
Look, we don't know here, so we can only just hypothesize and just think. But I assume Sia gets X amount for being captain as well. And then I think the try scorers get X amount more as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of money. Pumi,
I need to go back and research.
They'll be okay, Sia.
I need to see who scored tries. I need to make friends.
Ulrich is very excited. He said it's a good thing Pumi's in today because it's Guy Fawkes Day. So Pumi told us last time we spoke about this, last week, in fact, with Halloween and all the rest of it, that Guy Fawkes was a much bigger deal in the township when she was a little girl, and that you used to have fireworks and you would dress up as old people.
Mm-hmm.
And all the kids, in old people in drag outfits, and all the kids would be up and down the street.
Yeah, and all the old people would give you money.
That's amazing. I had no idea until you told us this last week. Anyway, is there any plan for tonight?
No.
No.
Oh, you're not living your best life.
In
I'm
the
not
tradition.
Living my best life because this, you know, part of it is, I don't know. That's why, you remember somebody wrote into us to say, like, it's still a big deal in Seshego, I think.
Yeah.
I'm like, Gotta plan me on like Sesotho outing. I must find out who do I know besides the Malemas from Sesotho.
Sorry, pardon my ignorance. Where is Sesotho, number
in,
one?
In Limpopo.
Oh, no. So an update on my random life. I got an update from my Uber driver. He finally contacted me.
Oh.
This is after my keys went MIA.
Sia had a drunken night on Saturday after the rugby. Who didn't in South Africa? And then he left his house keys on the back seat of the Uber.
At least he had a responsible drunken night taking the Uber.
And did you get your keys?
Have you got your keys back?
Because he's in Fos Loras. I'm like, Booty, I don't even know
where that is. So is he coming back anytime soon?
I say, just let me know when you're in the north. I'll find my keys there.
Really?
Oh, if he's in Fos Loras, we could make a plan for you.
Are you going to Fos Loras?
No, but a friend of mine's mom has a shop in Fos Loras, and she goes to the shop every day.
Well, thank you. Yeah,
and she lives in Bryanston.
As a corporate say, we'll take this conversation offline.
Offline. We'll offline this conversation. Thank and we'll you. Get your keys back.
Okay.
You see, unlike Gugu, I help my colleagues.
You guys clearly have a lot to deal with, don't you?
Well, all right, let's get into some news.
Let's get into some news, okay. There's a second twisted case that's currently being unpacked in the United States right now. You think of all of the couples who go through fertility treatments and the likes of IVF and what a personal and emotional journey that is. Well, a bit of a sick doctor has taken advantage of that situation because a Colorado-based fertility doctor secretly used his own sperm to impregnate a woman.
This happens more than people like to know.
Fathering her two daughters without consent.
Yeah, you see, there's some sick people in this world. So this guy's meant to be treating, obviously, couples who have fertility problems.
Mm.
And he goes and gets her impregnated.
It's just which begs the question, does the end justify the means?
And how does she
what do they want? What do they want?
How does she find out? I mean, they have to do DNA tests and then she discovers.
Yes.
Now that
what do they want, Gareth?
They wanted babies.
What do they have?
Babies. I hear you.
Sperm, it's not that simple. It's not that simple. His name is Dr. Paul Jones, and he promised a Cheryl Emmons that he would use an anonymous donor for her artificial inseminations. One could argue the donor was anonymous to Cheryl, so
what's her,
he really
what's her
like?
Main gripe with this? I mean, I don't think it's right that the doctor uses his own.
Yes.
But let's just for a moment consider that maybe there weren't other sperm donors
viable.
For her,
what's
and
her beef?
What Cheryl cites is she wants to know why did he do this, and this is for both her daughters born in 1980 and born
he's
in
a
1985.
How did she know that he was?
It's similar to another story I brought up. A couple of months ago.
Yeah.
But the funny thing with this story was, it was a couple who underwent IVF, and it was an Asian couple who went through IVF, and then the babies turned out white. So that was an obvious blunder. But with this one, these kids had a voucher to Ancestry.com. Mm. And they were just playing around with it, like, okay, yeah, let's see, let's figure it out. And then through Ancestry.com, they found out that they had at least 5 half-siblings. And they're like, hold up, wait,
which is possible if you're using an anonymous
but
donor.
But through doing more of that research, they found out that all roads
so
led back to
this anonymous.com, right?
There's Ancestry.com.
Ancestry.com. Mm-hmm. There's a Modern Love podcast about a guy who, and it's, I met my children before I met my partner, and they're all related. And he met his, so when he was in varsity or whatever, he did lots of donating.
Mm-hmm.
And he signed up. Ooh. And then found that he's got like 36
children.
Kids, yeah, that
amazing.
Are linked to his name. And 6 of them were something like that. But it's an insane story. But the most insane part of the story for me is that whole premise. The premise of you can be a 20-year-old student because you get paid. In the States, you get paid for donating sperm, right? Mm-hmm. So that's why a lot of people do it, is because they want the money or they sure. need the money. And now all of a sudden, you have all of these kids tracking you down.
Do you think... I would assume that...
But you have, so you have to sign up, you the parent, along with the kids. So that's how they then find each other. So all the kids who know that their father was a sperm donor, they sign up and they hope, and more people are signing up onto this thing so that they can find out. You know, Spike Lee had a film about this with a black guy.
But really? I would assume... Yeah,
Spike Lee has a film like that.
Clauses are tight enough in this day and age where if you do want to donate, you can say and specify if you want to be contacted or not.
Yeah, you can. But that's the thing about this website, this Ancestry.com website.
Yeah, is that
people,
screws everything
people, up. People sign up and put their information out there. They also put the years during which they were donating. So if you were born in 1980...
And, so then you know, you can look it up. But obviously they have to opt in. But still...
Crazy!
I don't know. Hey, there's, you see, there's this built-in thing with men as well. Like, we want to...
No?
No, we want to procreate. We want to leave our legacy. You know what I mean? Men want to spread our seed, so to speak. So there's a part of every guy, even if he's donated and he wanted to remain anonymous, there's probably some tiny part of him that he wants to know. He wants to see what his kids look like. He wants to know if they're smart. He wants to know if they're tall. He wants to know if they can run.
Wouldn't you have a little too much
paranoia?
The Spike
Lee film was called She Hate Me.
She Hate Me.
Mm.
Wow.
2004.
It would drive me crazy if I didn't know.
I think I'd want to know.
Where
are
they?
I've never thought about donating sperm, so... I mean, maybe it's something we should... You know, a friend of mine, when had a baby, she decided to have a kid without a father. And she found a sperm donor, and she's had the kid, and she's very happy, and the kid's very happy, and I don't know, it seems like everything's worked out pretty well. The old ideas are not necessarily holding up as well.
Yeah, I'll admit I might be very traditional in my thinking and have a lot of old ways about me. But it's this, I would think I'd have a bit of a niggly feeling of, where do I come from? Who is my father? I don't know.
If anybody's interested, the modern love thing is also, it's called First I Met My Children, Then I Met My Girlfriend. They're related.
Wow. Mm.
See, no, but back to the story, I do think it is a little twisted. This doctor does seem a little malpractice-y.
Yeah, I know, for sure. It's a betrayal of trust.
Yeah,
I don't know if you can do that.
Is it, though?
Yeah, I think so. They wanted an anonymous donor. He went and made it his. It's just, you know, slightly.
It was anonymous.
But more than that, it's the thought process. Why do it as well?
Dr. Robin says, on the IVF matter and donor sperm, there is always a shortage of donors, even now, especially in South Africa. That's probably how the quack justifies his behavior. So maybe we just don't have enough sperm donors. I mean, have you thought about that?
And do you know what? We focus so much on sperm donors. I wonder how many egg donors we have.
There are way less. And I've done the research. I thought you were going to say
you've done it. I'm like, what?
And it actually, you know, because unlike sperm, the eggs that a woman produces, you're born with the number of eggs, and they just mature at different times. So
they mature, they fry, they scramble.
So you've got,
they get poached.
So you've got a very small window.
That's a finite number.
There's a very small window of really viable, really, and all of the things that, you know. So the egg donors are much, much less. There's a clinic here in Sandton, actually, that harvests. And they'll give you hormone therapy for a couple of weeks so that you can harvest a lot of eggs. And it pays well.
Men are just such slubs, hey? We have it so easy.
Yeah,
and we still complain about things.
Much simpler to be a man.
Give a man on average 6.5 minutes.
Here's something interesting on the rugby players. They each get an initial 1.2 million rand for the win. Then comes all the performance fees and bonus and sponsors. So it gets close to 3 million each if they're lucky when they're done. How's that, huh?
Boom. Yo.
That's a good payday.
Yo, Mum Bimbi.
Out here looking for friends.
Yeah.
Holla at your boy. Can I do a post World Cup podcast? No, I'll go and interview them.
that what's that little one? Faf.
Yeah,
the clerk,
yeah. Right? He can wear
he looks as many like the speedos kind of as person. He wants. He looks like the kind of person that'll totally go apeshit and then like squander all his winnings. He totally looks like that kind of delinquent.
He looks like a good time. He looks like he will have a good time and just go apeshit with it. You are right.
I got a good story for you. Your meanest friend could actually be the one who cares about you most, a study says. Now listen to this. We all have that one friend who gives the meanest feelings and most honest reactions about all of our problems that may hurt us a little bit. This kind of relationship is normal for people who are close or best friends forever. We seek to ask our friends advice when we have problems. Could be family, love life, even at work. But why do we come to them when we know they'll give us negative or mean reactions? It may be the meanest, but it could be the most genuine and truest reaction that we deserve. So according to a study conducted by scientists at, I think it's the University of Maryland, your meanest friend is actually the one who cares about you the most. They seem tough on you because this is because what they want is the best for you. And then they go into the Association for Psychological Science and some close friends who can purposely impose negative feelings on their best friends because they think those negative feelings are not intended to hurt them, but rather to help them during difficult times. So if your friend is extremely mean to you, it might not be because they hate you. It might be because they love you the most. Isn't that nice? You like
so
it?
Do you buy
no.
that?
I don't know. I think it's probably about 50% right. Some friends are just mean because they're mean.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's why.
They should not be your friends.
Yeah, some of these are not good people. You know? Like Trump always says, you're not sending their best people. Sometimes you're not getting your best friends.
Talking anyway. About Trump, did you see Donald Trump Jr. has released a new book?
Oh, yeah?
It's called Triggered.
Oh, yes.
And in it, he says he is the second most hated person in the United States.
And the first
after his dad.
Yeah. I see.
Sure.
Because he's triggered.
He could change his name.
Yeah, Donald Trump.
Too late,
Donald
he looks
Trump
like,
Jr.
He looks like his father too much as well. That's another problem.
Sure. Isn't it the other one that looks more like him, though, Eric? I think Donald Trump Jr. doesn't look as much like him. You know, I've got to say, like, Donald... Really, talk about good sperm donor and egg donor. Like when he found Ivana, his first wife, the mother of
yes.
These three, he did well. She imparted yeah. some good genes into those kids. I mean, listen, I don't think the boys look any good, but that Ivanka looks fantastic. Yeah. And if you look at her father, you think, how could he have made that?
Yeah.
But it's because he chose a good wife.
No, she
good brood mare.
She was definitely.
I'm telling you. I like it. All right, let's talk to Emmanuel Castus. Let's find out what he's doing. There's this Dion Mayer series. I don't know if you've heard about it. Organized crime, diamond smuggling, black rhinos, terrorism. These are just a few of the ingredients in the highly buzzed about Trackers, based on Dion Mayer's crime novel of the same title. It premiered last week on Mnet. Pumi says it's like an hour and a half long, Emmanuel. Is that
the
true?
The first episode,
yeah.
Hi.
How are
guys?
You, dude?
No,
nice
good.
To see you, man.
It's been a long time, huh?
I haven't seen you in ages. Are you all right? So you're having a little bit of a sleep there on the sofa. You tired?
Yeah, I had a bit of a rough night. A little bit of a...
What did you do?
Sickly night. So.
Oh, you weren't feeling well?
Yeah.
Shit, man. I'm sorry.
I pulled myself out of bed just for you, man.
Thank you. we appreciate that.
Jeez, what a professional.
I know.
Look at this guy.
So apparently we're already... Two episodes in as the series continues to promise being a truly South African production telling a unique South African story. The new series features the likes of Sisanda Hena, Tapelo Mokwena, James Alexander, Sandy Schultz, Roland Marais, and our own guest this morning, Emmanuel Castus. So first of all, congratulations on being part of this star cast, by the looks of things.
Thank you. Yeah.
A mega production, hey?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's quite huge. It's you know, when you're on set and you're kind of filming it, you don't really have an idea of what's going to come out on screen. And then there was a premiere night a week before it launched.
Yeah.
And we saw it on the big screen at Monty.
And it's incredible. And you're even
mind-blowing. Yeah, yeah.
Well, you see, this is the thing about doing these productions, right? When you're in it, you have no idea.
Yeah.
You genuinely don't know because you can't see what everyone else is doing. You only do your bits.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And who's paying for all of this? Is this an Mnet production?
So there's a whole co-production. Yeah, yeah. So there's Mnet. There's HBO.
Oh, HBO yeah. involved. Oh,
and
wow.
then there is I've lost the German company's name.
It's the public broadcaster, ZDF.
ZDF, there you go. Thank you very much.
Now say it again, Emmanuel.
ZDF, there we go.
Very convincing.
He knows everything. So it's a six-part series.
Yes, but what they did was they took first and second episode and made it one, which was the first night on the 27th of October.
Oh, so it's going to be
so
five.
So it's almost like a pilot.
Okay.
So it's five, and every episode after that is 50 minutes.
How involved is Dion Mayer in all this?
He was very much involved. I mean, he oversaw the scripting and mm-hmm. all that kind of thing, and obviously it's his story.
Does he almost direct as well?
No. He wasn't directing. It was mainly just on the story side and telling the story as close to his book as possible.
Now, Pumi also tells me, again, I haven't watched anything here, and that's not anyone's fault except mine. I don't watch TV anymore. It's bizarre. I'm going to have to download this series.
It's
and
on
then
Showmax.
Watch it. I know, that's what I'm going to have to do. So she says it's really complex. There are a lot of stories running concurrently.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So the byline of the series is everybody leaves a trace. So it's basically a whole lot of people... Ooh. Tracing someone and trying to get somewhere, and everybody's got their different story of what they need.
And you play like a Muslim terrorist dude in the Burqa, right?
Suleiman Daoud. I play a Al-Qaeda commander.
Wow.
So there's a small little, it's called Al-Ajna. It's like a small little terrorist faction cell, yeah. They're like really not actually that serious. They're just talkers inside the Boer Kaap.
Okay.
But all of a sudden, they have contacted this huge... He's like a huge entity. He basically trained some of Bin Laden's army, you know, that kind of guy. And they bring him in to Cape Town. So this sets off the PBI, Sandy Schultz and Tapelo Mokwena. That's like an investigative... arm of the government, because they see that this guy's come into town and they're like, why is he here? It's like he's just way too big for these small time guys. So what's going on?
Is it difficult to play a kind of a Muslim guy in the Boer Kaap if that's not your background? Some people, there's going to be controversy around this, right?
Before the show even started, there were a couple of tweets out there, but he's of Egyptian descent.
Okay.
And my parents were actually born in Egypt, so I kind of have the connection.
You can claim that.
I can claim that.
But you know what people are like. They go, what's this Greek South African dude doing playing a Muslim in the Boer Kaap?
That's what one of the comments was. So many Muslims in the country, and they choose a Greek. But then the comment after that was, "So did you audition?"
because there's so many different people involved in the production.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's going to be shown in quite a number of countries.
Yes.
It's not just going to be shown in South Africa. So one of the things that I saw when I was watching it is how much work everybody's done at kind of neutralizing the South African accents.
Yeah, I don't know if it was a conscious choice, but
okay.
Yeah, I mean the creators did sort of focus on the accents, Even my accent is a very, very neutralized Arabic accent, because an Egyptian accent has like Zs instead of Ths. So the creators were a bit worried that I was going to be sounding a little German.
Oh, really?
So they actually asked me to sort of pull back the accent a little and make it more of a sort of global Arabic
accent. How does that even work? Do you sit then and go through your lines and kind of change the way you say them?
Yeah, you have to, yeah.
What, do you practice in front of a mirror, or do you just say it to yourself a couple of times?
So actually, on the one occasion, I came onto set and I did the scene in the Egyptian accent, and they were like, we need to change it, we need to neutralize it. So
wow.
I had to do it
straight
on
away,
the fly,
huh?
Right there, yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah, so
people think this acting thing is easy.
You know,
how long did it take you guys to put the whole series together?
Five months. Well, that's just the shooting.
The
There's obviously the pre-production. Yeah, the principal photography, exactly. I think they started the process in June last year. The casting and all of that kind of stuff, and then it got, and then I actually was cast right at the end. Because I went in for a reading. I wasn't even cast in the show. I went in for the script readings, the initial script readings, because James Gracie wasn't here. He was in his James Gracie on screen. Yeah. He was in L.A. He lives in L.A. So I went in to read for him, and then I waffled through the Arabic quite smoothly, and they were like, hold on, can we see you for this part?
Oh, look at that. Yeah. So you didn't audition for the role. They kind of chose you.
I still had to audition.
Okay.
But they like saw how I sort
That's
of did the
reading.
That's
pretty cool, man.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
So, and you're not a stranger to South African screens. This is, you know, you're like a veteran, as it were. But this production was very different. Take us a little bit behind the scenes on the differences between this production, even though it's an all South African production, versus kind of an F. Saunders or that kind of we're used to seeing on our screens.
Yeah, well, you see, we had more time and we had a bigger budget. So, you know, I've always been under the impression, I've always believed that you don't need huge budget to tell good stories. But then I realized, hold on, you actually need some money to tell some aspects of a story. Like if you see some of the cinematography, it's incredible. You know, all that sort of drone footage and like sort of the sky shots of everything. Yeah. It's amazing. So
and
I think from
stuff
that
doesn't
perspective,
come cheap.
No, it doesn't.
You have to outlay some severe capital to get that.
So from that perspective, it was different on that level. And then we obviously had three different kind of teams. The director is Finnish. Some of the producers were British. Then the South African producers. So you had that whole conglomerate of people adding their ideas to make it more international. But I think what's important, and I think what Dion Meyer really wanted to stick to, is the authenticity and the authenticity of the backdrop of the film, of the series and all that kind of thing. Because if you don't tell it authentically, even though you're trying to make it globally accessible, it's not going to work.
So because it gives it that granularity, right?
It
has enough detail in it to be believable. When you filmed this months ago, like last year, are you forced to keep things quiet? People ask you, because I'm thinking, you know, if I go out with friends of mine and like, what are you up to? I can say to them, well, I've got this show going on and I've got this happening, and they can find out about it. You can't talk about this if you are a year ahead of release.
Yeah, not a word.
You can't say anything. You can't say what role you're playing. You can't talk about whether or not you're involved in a project.
So this for me is one of the weirdest things about the way the South African industry operates.
Yeah.
Right? Because why do that? You know, when you think about the fact that Marvel has a new Black Panther film coming out in 2022. We know who the cast is. We know who the director is. We know, you know what I'm saying? Like, the reason those guys do so well is because they're going to spend 3 years. That's
promoting
this thing. It's getting us all hyped up about it. Here, it's like a week before the thing is screened, suddenly everyone's talking about this Trackers thing, and we're like, well, what is it? You haven't had enough time to get even excited about it, to read up about it. If we'd known about it last year, it would have made the sales
especially
of the book
especially for the people like you in it, and you know, you have this fan base of people who've been watching you on TV and in movies in South Africa for some time now, so they know.
Yeah, yeah.
They want to see what you're up to.
But some of the cast that have been cast aren't that well known, you know, so it's like kind of, and it's new, because I've had some comments from people saying, oh, it's great to see some guys that you haven't, that you don't normally see on the series.
People always say that, they're trying to be nice.
What are they trying to say?
Yeah. The reason these people are unknown.
No.
And maybe it's got to do, maybe it's also got to do with the stigma around, like, that South African audience's sort of place on South African productions. Because there was something on social media where someone was like, oh, they're advertising the hell out of this thing. I bet you it's crap like everything else. And I'm like, so I don't know if...
Let me guess, you read that on social media.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, keyboard warriors. Yeah,
a bunch of people who are desperately unhappy that are busy giving feedback.
But it's also budget, you know. It's also like that a marketing budget is a huge thing. So these big studios in the States can afford to spend millions on a budget. I mean, Mnet's gone huge with this.
Good for
them. What's also really nice watching it is seeing kind of people that are... This is not the kind of typical South African type of story or South African type with, because here we have very stereotypical. We have content that is made for black people, content that is made for white people, content that is made for some kind of urban type of homogenous thing, right? And there are actors, there are some, like Jerry Mofokeng is an incredible
The legend.
Incredible actor that a lot of white South Africans have not been exposed to.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're probably watching this thing going, nice new talent. You know?
Yeah. And he's like a theater stalwart.
Meanwhile, the man's got like years and years of experience. But it's also nice to see it open up and become something that's a little bit more multinational, that's a little bit the stories.
Yeah.
Even though, I mean, there are a lot of stories, so you have to be awake to watch that thing.
And it's amazing, like crime is such a big genre.
Absolutely.
People love it on TV. Yeah. They love it in podcasting. It's just an enormous genre. And man, do we have a lot of material in South Africa when it comes to true crime. Are you excited also, and I mean, I'm a little excited for you, that you've now become an actor who does these kinds of things much more than you do the TV short stuff that you used to do.
Yeah,
And I suppose this was inevitable. This is an evolution of you and your work as an actor and all the rest of it. But it's also a different universe to that plodding day-to-day stuff that the soap operas and the regular income. Let's not mess with it.
That's the great thing about that. Yeah,
sure, the soap operas... The very best actors and actresses in South Africa go into soaps because it's reliable, steady income, right?
Yeah.
But you must be pleased to be leaving that behind.
It was my training ground, and it's another aspect of my career that I has served me well, and I'm proud of. But it's done. Yeah, right. It's time to do some more serious and, well, not that it's not serious, but there's like higher entertainment value.
Isn't it amazing how these series, these mini-series, these TV series, they've become as big as the movie business?
Yeah, it's huge.
And you find these A-list movie actors in America who are doing TV series because that's also where the real money is, and that's where they get to do some cool stuff.
Yeah.
Like if you're
especially
doing
limited series, you know, so like the short kind of 5-6 episodes.
Yeah, it's incredible. You drive around LA, and all the billboards have these. But actors who you haven't seen for years as well coming out, and like you know Winona Ryder, we hadn't seen her for such a long time, and then she's there on Stranger Things. And
yeah, correct.
For three seasons, and it's.
What are you watching?
What am I watching?
Yeah, I mean, what do you get to see in between?
I'm watching Schitt's Creek. Have you seen it?
Oh,
how good is that?
Fantastic. Uh-huh. First of all, the father and the mother in that show.
Mm-hmm.
What's his name?
Daniel.
Eugene Levy.
Eugene Levy is so goddamn funny. And the mother.
She's insane.
She's like a Canadian, also like a soap opera actress or something. Yeah, and she is unbelievable as the mom. That Schitt's Creek has got to be the funniest show that
it's
I've seen.
It's incredible. And like just the subtleties of the scenes. So, and like when they finish a scene together, like the brother and sister, he often turns around with a little smirk in his face. And I'm like, these guys must be close to corpsing on a regular basis on that set, because it's just
so. You know. You can also tell there's a little bit of improv going on.
Yeah,
some of
absolutely.
The time, which is beautiful. So what the story is, in case you haven't seen Schitt's Creek, I think I mentioned this like almost a year ago, because it's been out for ages.
Yeah, I think they're doing their final season now.
I love this show. Mm-hmm. So it's about this family, these really rich people who live in New York, and then one day. There's tax evasion or something, and the FBI just come
SEC.
In and they just close the whole thing down, and they send these people. The only place they can go, the only asset they're allowed to keep, is this village called Schitt's Creek that the father bought as a joke for the son, and they end up living in like a motel.
Yeah,
God, it's funny, and the things they have to go through, it's just the best.
It's brilliant.
I'm so glad you brought that up. I've actually got to get back into it.
So Emmanuel, is this your international springboard?
I hope so. Yeah, it's going to. I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, but it's releasing in the States because it's Cinemax as well. And yeah, I hope so. I hope, because it's a nice character. It's a great character. He's not always there, but he's in the background and he's present all the time because of the story, you know, which is great. It's nice to sort of come into an episode and do a scene. I mean, what happens at the end is actually mind-blowing. Oh. Like when I finished the last episode, I like literally had to stop for 20 minutes and go, holy crap, this is going to be
seriously
insane.
Okay, well,
it's insane.
Don't spoil
anything.
Yeah,
I won't spoil anything.
But is there also some element of him that's dark, that's transformative, that's those things that actors love getting their teeth into? Because nobody likes playing the good guy.
Yeah.
You know, it's not as much fun.
Yeah, well, there is. Like, I mean, at the end, what you see is like just, yeah. there's absolutely no way your mind is going to go that way. When you see the final outcome of what actually happens, it's like,
oh, I like that.
Yeah.
I love it.
But yeah, that's yeah, hopefully that'll spring me there. But at the same time, I was shooting something in Cape Town called Warrior. I don't know if you've seen the Warrior series.
No, tell me.
It's also HBO Cinemax, and it's
look at you cleaning up.
It's a series based on the writings of Bruce Lee, which is incredible. He wrote, he created this character because he wasn't being cast. He was about to be cast in the first kind of Western, Chinese Western, and then the studio thought, okay, maybe he's not going to be like sort of be accepted by the American audience, because it was like in the 60s.
Yeah, 70s. Sure. There was a lot of prejudice.
Yeah.
So
he created this character, Asan, which is a Chinese immigrant who comes into San Francisco to make it.
Yeah.
So his daughter found.
Sounds like
yeah.
Someone.
So his daughter found this. And took it to the creators of Fast and the Furious, and to Jonathan Tropa, who's the creator of Banshee.
Wow!
And they created this series that's based on the steelworkers in China.
So please don't tell me you're playing Bruce Lee. No, they really are stretching you a little.
Well, you know, and a Muslim Al Qaeda leader and a Bruce Lee. Yeah, so I play a little detective on that and play opposite.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so.
And Cape Town is really, it's doing very well in terms
beautiful,
of the movie
yeah.
business right
yeah.
now, huh?
Yeah, I mean, when I flew down for wardrobe fittings for the two series, for Trackers and Warrior, I was talking to some of the crew, the drivers, and mm-hmm. they were saying there was not any crew left in Cape Town.
Wow.
There was so much stuff happening. They were shooting something like 14 TV series and 16
Amazing.
Movies or something.
Job creation. This is good.
Yeah.
And again, let's give a little bit of credit here, because this is one area where government did step in and create all kinds of tax
Look,
breaks.
Look, Cape Town yeah. Film Office, the yeah. DTI's
right.
co-production.
That's good stuff.
It's a lot.
So let's give credit where it's due for a change. It's one of the things that you see where you open up and you give people breaks and
And South Africa does have some of the best crew in the
Absolutely.
World.
Absolutely.
And in Cape Town, in terms of weather, it's usually a winner. You've got plenty of you know, if you're paying
and
in
locations.
Rands, if you're paying in rands for a production that you're then selling in dollars, you're making a huge profit. So it makes sense for people.
And you've got the incentives as well. So
yeah, it's superb. Okay, well, listen. All I can say is congratulations to you. We're thrilled.
Thank you.
We're going to watch Trackers. Pumi's already on it. I'm going to get onto it now. It's on DSTV Channel 101, and it started October the 27th, but you can get it on Showmax as well. And there are a bunch of really talented actors and actresses, including our own Emmanuel Castis, on there. And Dion Mayer's seventh book is the basis for this crime thriller. So there's a bit of rhino poaching that happens. Mm. There's smuggling, diamond smuggling. There's Al-Qaeda. It's everything. This is a very, very cool idea.
Well, the rhino wasn't poached, but...
It was smuggled.
Oh.
They smuggled diamonds inside the... Oh, am I giving... No, it's been... Oh. Yeah.
Put it in the arsehole of the rhino?
If you haven't seen it. No, yeah.
All right, so this is what we're excited about at the moment. Thank you very much. Emmanuel Castis, everybody. An episode of Blind History on the way for you this morning. And Pumi, thank you very much. Emmanuel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will see you tomorrow, but don't miss this. It's episode 8 of season 2 now. Lincoln, the President of the United States, the 16th President, Honest Abe. Are you ready for some Honest Abe?
Honest Abe. Yeah, also hero to Barack Obama.
Yeah, what?
Hero what? To Barack Obama.
He
Abraham
did.
Lincoln.
He wrote to him?
Wait, no, how? Hero to. He's Obama's hero.
Oh, a hero to.
Oh,
sorry.
Hero to. I also heard I was he say. Wrote to.
I'm yes, like, what? He wrote to in the time machine.
What time traveling?
In the time machine that he.
All right, everybody calm down. Jesus. Getting very, sorry. A hero to Barack Obama. Yeah, well, he was the guy who brought about the Emancipation Proclamation, among other things. My favorite moment in Lincoln history, just before we get to Blind History, is this, where Gilbert Gottfried plays Abraham Lincoln.
Class, please welcome our graduation speaker, President Abraham Lincoln.
Hiya, schmucks! 47 years ago, I was broke, just like you. But now I'm the president, and I'm so fucking rich, I can have all the licorice I want. Where's my speaking fee?
I don't think that's the real President Lincoln.
Oh, if any men want to fuck me in the ass, I'll be out by the barn.
I love it. It's from A Million Ways to Die in the West. But the real Abraham Lincoln is coming up now in Blind History. It's brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters. Here he is. Stovepipe hat, 420 speeches, and a bullet in the back of his head. That's what people know about Abraham Lincoln. But there's a whole lot more to know, too. All of it is on the way in this special episode of your favorite series, Blind History. 5 days after the surrender of the South and the effective end of the American Civil War, President Abraham Lincoln went to the theater with his wife to watch a comedy. The events which then unfolded would have effects on the world that would echo through eternity. His assassination would spark new divisions, uncomfortable conversations, and ultimately the forging of a nation broken apart by civil war. Edward Curtis, an army surgeon in attendance at Lincoln's autopsy, recounted that a bullet clattered into a waiting basin during the doctor's removal of Lincoln's brain. He wrote that the team stopped to stare at the offending bullet. The cause of such mighty changes in the world's history as we may never perhaps realize. Blind History, Season 2. We're going to go to America in this episode. We'll talk about a guy who is regarded by most historians, scholars, and the public as being one of the greatest American presidents of all, a man who wore bizarre hats, which no one wears anymore. I mean, no one would be seen dead in one of these hats, mostly because eventually Lincoln was seen dead in one of these hats. Abraham Lincoln, the American statesman, lawyer, 16th president, and Anthony Medder and I are here to guide you through a little life history lesson of Abraham Lincoln's. You like him?
Yeah, I liked him a lot. He was easygoing, Aquarian.
Yeah.
Which I think is...
Oh, a star sign?
Star sign is an Aquarian.
That's very important.
Well, I mean, I'm an Aquarian, so I thought, you know, there must be some link.
Then they must be nice people.
Exactly. That's I was leading up to that.
Abe, Honest Abe, as they called him, he came from a poorer frontier family in Illinois, and he was self-educated. He eventually went into politics at quite a young age, actually. He became the leader of a party called the Whigs, which mirrored more or less the two-party system of the UK. The Whigs were more the liberals. He eventually obviously became a state legislator and eventually a congressman. And then he left government just suddenly, went into law again. Sounds a little bit like Pixley Kaisakaseme.
So first of all, he was well-liked. I mean, he was a master storyteller. People loved him. So wherever he went, he could tell these stories and draw crowds in, and they all wanted to listen to all the different stories. So he would take a whole lot of facts, fluff them up, and come into these incredible stories. So he gained popularity. This was a driving force in his life. He could speak to the people, from leaders of business to top agricultural leaders to the people on the street.
I heard that Abraham Lincoln was actually a really, you know, like an ordinary guy.
Yes.
Like everybody felt they could relate to him. He wasn't trying to be extremely clever. He wasn't trying to be fancy or rich or, you know, from a great family or any of that stuff. He was a very down-to-earth, straightforward, salt-of-the-earth kind of guy.
I suppose
that's where his appeal lay for so many people. But he did get angry, and he was really passionate about the issue of slavery. For some reason, because in America this was not the norm, he was really uptight when he heard about the Democrats opening up new territories to slavery and decided to go back into politics after practicing law.
Correct.
So it was a real motivation for him. And he became leader of the new Republican Party, mostly because he got attention. He got into a debate with the leader of the Democrats, Stephen A. Douglas, and he just wiped the floor with this guy. He tore him to pieces. In the debate, everyone said Lincoln is the guy to watch. And subsequently, he ran for president in 1860. And he swept the North. I mean, there wasn't a state that didn't like him. He came in with great results across the board. And obviously, the southern states took this as a very bad sign.
They did. And then they decided to leave.
Yeah, secession.
Seven of them.
They considered Abraham Lincoln's election as a declaration of war against their right, their constitutional right to own slaves. And so they seceded from the Union.
That's correct. But if we go back, when you said just earlier about being an ordinary man, I mean, he was born in a shoebox, really. It was a tiny little place.
That's really shit. I've seen pictures of it.
Yeah, it was tiny. That was in Kentucky, and the mom couldn't read, but she was very intelligent. Dad was a quiet guy. And they moved, because of slavery, out of Kentucky, and that's where they ended up in Illinois finally.
He was actually self-taught, right?
Correct. Yeah, 1 year in school. President of the United States, and actually one of the greatest presidents, he had 1 year in school.
Makes President Zuma look like an overachiever.
Yeah, exactly. You know, they said between Washington, Abe Lincoln, and Donald Trump are the greatest presidents of the United States.
Don't know about the last one.
Yeah, yeah.
He was not pleased when the South declared secession from the Union.
Not at all.
And he confronted radical Republicans in his own party who actually wanted harsher treatment of the South. He reined them in. He confronted war Democrats who wanted to go straight to war. And won over the moderates, obviously, in the result of that. He was against anti-war Democrats because he called them copperheads, and he pitted these factions against each other. So he was very clever about getting his enemies to fight amongst themselves so that they didn't fight with him.
And the Confederates actually declared war on the Union, so meaning declared war on what should have been the United States.
Right.
And after that point, they went to war, the Civil War, and he used that to his advantage on the slavery side. One of the big points he said was he didn't want to go against the law of the land, and he felt the voters had to make a decision on slavery. He was anti-slavery, but it would be very difficult for him as president to pass that. So he used the war as an opportunity with the Emancipation Proclamation in that any slave that was captured or managed to escape into Union territory was free. And
that's
that
right.
caused mayhem.
And he actually ordered the army because part of the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863 was that the army was ordered to protect escaped slaves. And correct. They were encouraged on the border to outlaw slavery. So that's obviously the border between the North and South. And then eventually they pushed through the 13th Amendment, which outlawed slavery in the whole of the continental United States. It was quite a big move.
That was a significant move.
Again, I mean, slavery had supposedly been abolished already. But the South, their whole economy was based on slavery.
Correct.
And it was agrarian, so it was quite backward. The North had all the industry and all the good ideas and the real businesses and all the rest of it. The South was still very backward in many ways. And one of the most backward things about them was the fact that they had slaves.
Yeah. Although there were four states that decided to stay with the Union.
Mm.
And that became tricky for him because then he left them with the fact that they had slaves. So he had to work it out somehow.
Yeah.
He had to figure out how he was going to
We look at a lot of this stuff, and I remember listening to a previous episode of this series. And we look at history and we say, well, according to the mores and the norms of now, they should have done this and they could have done that. But it didn't work like that. And
it's a different world.
If he just tried to outlaw slavery on the face of it, he would have been out of office very, very quickly. I mean, eventually they did get him out of office, but it was because of a bullet from a gun.
Exactly.
He did make that very famous Gettysburg Address, which has been quoted a million times, and it starts with a dating 67 years ago, our ancestors. Anyway, the point of the Gettysburg Address is that it brought nationalism, republicanism, equal rights, liberty, and democracy to the fore. And those were very big ideals of his and things that he really wanted to engender into the United States going forward. And he succeeded largely.
And can you imagine, to your point, it's a very different time. Presidents didn't speak to the people.
No.
So the fact that he had that opportunity, look, Gettysburg, he opened a cemetery for the amount of people that were killed in the Union-Confederate War.
Mm.
And a significant amount of people were killed. And it was a very powerful speech. And the people had never seen somebody that's going to talk to them like that. He was incredibly popular. People didn't actually say a word after that speech.
They didn't applaud. They didn't do anything.
They were blown away. Just,
yeah, they were completely gobsmacked.
Completely, yeah. From that perspective, he managed to explain what was going on in his head.
And he was conciliatory. Like, he didn't say we must take out retribution on the South now. These are our brothers. We must embrace them in the new United States going forward. But he wasn't mean about it.
Not at all. He played Dixie. He gave a speech. Finally, when Lee was taken down by Ulysses S. Grant, and they had that, there was the peace treaty that was set up, he played Dixie. He says, I'm so glad now that this is part of our country once again.
Hmm. He obviously was very involved in the war himself because he was one of those guys who couldn't just be a politician that appointed the generals and left it alone. He closely supervised every single move during the war. He was very involved in how the naval blockade was put into play, which was a major part of why the South lost in the end, because they just throttled their supply lines. And the South was supported by the French largely at that stage, which people forget. But they also managed to keep Britain out of it, which was important because it was an American civil war. They didn't want international interference. And when he'd ended slavery and the war was over, he managed a massive reconciliation campaign and went around the country trying to get people to get along a little better. It was a big deal in those days, really big deal. He was shot by John Wilkes Booth in April 1865 in a theater, Ford Theater in Washington. The guy was an actor.
Correct. And he was pro-slavery.
That's right.
And he was said to be the handsomest man in America. That's what they said.
I got a question for you. Why is it that serial killers or assassins are always... There was three names, John Wilkes Booth, Lee Harvey Oswald.
It's true.
Have you noticed that?
Yeah, exactly.
They always have three names. Even who was John Lennon's killer? Mark David Chapman. Always three names. It's very
bizarre.
Maybe
it's because they decide to say it as that because, I mean, I've got a few middle names, so it could be just...
Maybe you're an assassin.
If I assassinated somebody, they might say all of that, but I can't really answer that question. But what this guy did was, he was standing in the crowd when he gave that speech and when he played Dixie, and they got a photograph of him and his henchmen standing next to each other, and you can just see their faces were grim, and he was mad. He said that Lincoln is going to destroy him. He was just starting his second term. The Civil War just ended or was in the process of ending. And this guy's going to destroy our country. So he took it upon himself. He thought he'd be a national hero once he'd murdered or assassinated Lincoln. And he knew the theater so well because of the fact that he'd acted there so much. Shot him in the back of the head, then jumped dramatically.
From the balcony down onto the stage.
Down onto the stage, disappeared, and went into hiding. They found him. The whole of America went into massive mourning of the loss of such an incredible president. And they found him and killed him while he was trying to run away.
But what it did do is it did turn Lincoln into a martyr.
Correct.
And he became the symbol that everyone could rally around. And in some way, it probably unified America even more. He's ranked, as I said earlier, as one of the greatest presidents of all time. The fact that he had, during that fairly short term as president, he'd managed to preserve the Union, lead the country through civil war, abolish slavery, strengthen the federal government, and modernize the U.S. economy. These are not small achievements.
Not at all. And what he did was, with so little education, he self-taught himself, and his stepmom helped him. He really loved his stepmom. And he read so many books. He went to the bar himself after being self-taught. So there's so many things that he did. He had a very unsuccessful stint as a congressman. And then he was president. It was absolutely crazy what he did. It's almost like whatever position he went into, he was made for it. It was almost like he was made for this position. War. He didn't know anything about war. If you look at who he was fighting against.
Robert E. Lee, yeah.
He'd been a hero in the Mexican War. The only thing Abraham Lincoln got was mosquito bites from a little incursion they had with some of the Indians. So he had no experience, but he turned out to be a decent strategist. He kicked McClellan out, who was his first general. The troops loved McClellan, but he would never engage. And it frustrated the heck out of Lincoln, so he said, no, I'm going to do this myself. He got Ulysses S. Grant, which was a phenomenal general. And with him and his strategic thinking, and the Emancipation Proclamation made a big difference, because then they started sneaking out of southern states, all the slaves. Mm. He managed to achieve incredible results.
Yeah, he looked really horrible, though. I mean, he was an ugly bastard.
Yeah, he was.
He really is. I mean, I see him on the, I think he's on the $5 bill. And you think, there can't be a person that ugly. He had a wart right on the side of his face, and this weird little beard, and those long hats, and it's just a terrible look. It really is. It's a very bad look. Of course, he didn't die there and then in the theater either. He lived for about a few hours after that, and he got an enormous funeral. Mm. And it was the first time that really pictures of a funeral of that scale have ever been taken, because photography was quite a new thing. And obviously, it's now part of American national history.
Correct. The President's way. Day, it's him in Washington, right. I believe. And still today, they take the trek back to his hometown, the same trek he took from Springfield to the White House. People still do a pilgrimage where everybody gets on the train and follows the sad couple of days where he's on the train and the coffin gets taken back to Springfield.
Amazing. So there he is, one of the greatest presidents of the United States, Abraham Lincoln. Thanks for listening to the award-winning Blind History, brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters. CliffCentral.com